You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, the protests may be top of mind for many of us here in Minnesota, but the novel coronavirus hasn't gone away. In fact, as the nation reached and surpassed a tragic milestone of 100,000 American deaths from the pandemic, Minnesota was seeing a spike in hospitalizations. In this state, we're closer to 25,000 cases over the course of the pandemic, and as of yesterday morning, 1,050 people had died from the disease. Nobles County, Minnesota, has one of the highest per capita caseloads in the state and is considered to be a hot spot in the nation. And now public health authorities are worried about what the virus is doing as people congregate and march shoulder to shoulder in the Twin Cities and around the country. And that's where we're beginning this morning with two guests from the Minnesota Health Department, Minnesota Health Commissioner Jan Malcolm and State Infectious Disease Specialist Chris Ayersman are with us. And as they join us, we're ready for your questions. What do you want to know about our state's testing capacity? What do you want to know about the effect of the businesses that are opening here? And what Commissioner Malcolm thinks about the coming fall and winter? So do you know where to go get a test? Do you know if you need a test? Do you know how to get the results? Do you know about how much capacity Minnesota has to do those tests? What do you want to know about businesses opening? And what do you want to know about what our guests think about what lies ahead in the fall and winter? Commissioner Malcolm, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Well, good morning, Carrie. Thank you for the opportunity.
Chris Ayersman, really nice to have you back on the show. Thanks so much for doing this.
Glad to be here.
Commissioner, you are clearly concerned about how the virus may, you know, see opportunity here among all these people that are standing and marching and shouting shoulder to shoulder. What's your chief concern about that?
Well, we certainly know that close gatherings of large numbers of people in close proximity to each other for an extended period of time is kind of a recipe for spread. The mitigating factors, though, is that it was outdoors, and we appreciate that many people were wearing masks, which is certainly not perfect protection, but is helpful. There are many theories out there about how big of a spike we might see as a result of the events of this past week, which were absolutely heartbreaking and tragic for so many reasons.
Chris, It sounds like the commissioner is saying the science isn't in on how an infectious disease like this one is going to behave in the temperatures that we've got and the proximity that we see people in. What are some of the scenarios that you're seeing that Minnesotans should be aware of as they make a decision of whether to join a protest or not?
Well, as the commissioner said, we know that when people are gathering close together, that provides more opportunities for spread. And we know that when people are outside, that's a much better setting than, say, being in an indoor location.
Mm-hmm.
What's challenging is we now know, which we didn't know when this all started, that there is a big role for asymptomatic transmission. And so that is really challenging because even if people are, you know, heeding our admonition to stay home if they're sick, there certainly is the possibility that they could not have symptoms and still be infectious. And so that's the challenge whenever you're getting together in a large group. It's not quite as easy as saying that person over there is coughing or that person over there looks to have symptoms. I'm going to be judicious and make sure I don't get too close to them. With this disease, we don't have that luxury. And so I think if people are weighing the decision, should I join? I mean, obviously, it's a very personal decision, but keep in mind your own underlying health conditions. We do know that people with underlying health conditions will have likely a more severe outcome with COVID. And
okay,
so certainly you should want to keep that in mind as you're considering how you want to express yourself given all the serious events of the last days.
Good. I'll come back on the asymptomatic qualities of this because I have more questions on that. But we have some questions here from our listeners to Alexei in Minneapolis. Alexei, what's your experience with this? What's your story?
Well, my story is that I went to the OMRI to get tested. Mm-hmm. So I live in a congregative care setting.
Okay.
And one of my staff tested positive for COVID. So I went to get tested, and I am still waiting 2 weeks out for the results. Any, is there a reason why it's taking so long for the results to get back?
Commissioner Malcolm, why the backlog on getting the results?
Well, Alexei, I'm really sorry to hear that you've been waiting that long. Chris may have comment on this too, but there is a pretty wide range of turnaround time depending on which lab was doing the testing. There, some of our health systems in Minnesota have contracts with national laboratories that that do tend to take longer to turn around if the lab samples are being done at our own public health lab or at Mayo or the university. Those tend to turn around much more quickly. Alexei, maybe it would be good to check back with your clinic or wherever you got tested to see if they can give you any more information.
Chris, 2 weeks seems like a long time. I'm sure you're going to say, hey, Alexei, you should be taking precautions. But, you know, he's putting his life on pause while other people are emerging and kind of going back to their regular routines.
Right. And I think that, Alexei, I understood that you said you got tested at the National Guard testing and you haven't heard back. And I think one of the challenges that occurred during that testing situation is that they had so many people that were showing up that they had some challenges with getting all the information that they needed from people. I know I've heard that they have had challenges making sure that they had contact information. And so perhaps we can connect with Alexei offline and work on this. But
okay.
I think that may be part of the challenge. But yes, 2 weeks is a long time, and that's why we certainly, our goal is that the results are available to people in a much more timely manner because exactly, Alexei's a healthcare worker wanting to do the right thing about protecting the residents of, you know, where he's working. So we'll work on...
Yeah,
we can figure that out.
Chris, we will get his contact information and then send that to you, okay, off air.
Thank you.
All right. To Laura in Minneapolis. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
What do you want to know about this?
I was wondering if the Department of Health has any concerns about some of the police tactics we've been seeing over the past week, the use of pepper spray, mace, tear gas, in some cases looking pretty unwarranted in some videos. Is there a concern that those type of chemical irritants will end up exacerbating COVID in our communities?
Commissioner, I've wondered about this too, because if you get into tear gas, your eyes stream, your nose streams, more bodily fluids out there, people huffing harder to breathe. What have you observed about that? What are you concerned about?
Well, Laura, I think it's a great observation, and certainly that is something that we know is potentially another thing that can exacerbate the risk for all the reasons that Carrie, you just cited. We've certainly had conversations about that. I think our colleagues in public safety are really doing a pretty remarkable job of trying to be very measured in their response. But I think it's just another, you know, in a situation where there's so much going on and so much urgent need to control any harm that can come from not from peaceful protest, but from some of the more confrontational tactics. That's just another reason, as Chris said earlier, for people to be thoughtful and cautious about whether that's an environment they want to put themselves in.
Well, Commissioner, is this a moment to maybe say to police departments, you know, use this sparingly because you're using this for a purpose, but you're not thinking about some of the other consequences that may come from being in the midst of a pandemic while you're using these tactics? Have you advised anybody on that?
Yeah, there have been conversations through the Emergency Operations Center, and I think it's certainly a valid point, and I know that they're being as careful as they believe they can be.
Chris, Carol in Minneapolis called. She says, I'm trying to reconcile what I hear from the Minnesota Health Department and what is really happening. My mother is in a long-term setting. They had no positive cases in her home until last week when a worker had a positive test. I assume the home would then test all the people in the home, but they said no, it's only recommended, not mandated. So they aren't testing anyone. She adds, I'm a little stunned. Are they following the right policy, Chris?
The department has put out guidance on how testing should be done, and we do recommend that if there's a case in a facility that they consider testing. But it is true that it is not a mandate.
Why isn't it mandated?
Because there are lots of considerations for the facility. It's not that they shouldn't do it, but they need to have plans in place for staffing, for cohorting of patients, that type of thing. So I don't want to give the impression that we don't want them to do it. We do want them to do it. It just hasn't gotten to the point where it is a mandate. But keep in mind that even for vaccination, the things that we feel so absolutely strongly about, those are the recommended vaccines, and they're even with that, there is an exemption. So at this point, it is a recommendation. It is a strong recommendation, and I certainly wouldn't want a facility to think that because it isn't mandated. I mean, we tend not to mandate things because we have such great cooperation through our health systems without that. Mm-hmm. But I certainly wouldn't want a facility to think that because it hasn't been mandated, that means that it's not something that they shouldn't be thinking about and planning for. But I do want to acknowledge that there is planning that needs to take place before the testing starts, because there will be results that they'll have to deal with. And if they test and don't have a plan for how they will cohort their patients and consider infection prevention and all of those things, they've gone through that whole process, and it won't have the outcome that we all want it to have.
Well, Chris, I have to wonder why a facility at this stage in the pandemic doesn't have the kind of plan that you've just described. And is your recommendation that Carol call the home and say, it might not be an absolute, but the recommendation is from the MDH that you do this testing? And what's your plan for that?
Yeah, I think it's a fair thing to reach out to the facility and say that the department wants facilities to test if they have a case, and that, you know, the expectation would be that they should be looking into that and making a plan for it. I think the response to say, well, we don't have to do it, so we're not going there,
yeah,
is probably not the response that we want to hear. We want them to say, yep, we're making our way to do this. We have plans to do it, that type of thing. But I do want to acknowledge, as you said, I mean, they should have plans in place, but they need to be ready to activate those plans at the time they start their testing.
Okay. Two guests who lead the Minnesota Health Department, Commissioner Jan Malcolm is with us from Minneapolis, and Chris Ayersman. You've heard her, I think, frequently on this show. She's the Minnesota Department of Health Infectious Disease Director. And we're taking your calls about all kinds of questions about how the pandemic is being managed, how you get access to testing, what happens if the virus erupts in a congregate care center that you have a relative in. Why is it taking so long to get results from some of those tests? Who really ought to be tested? What are our guests' predictions for what comes next over the next few months? I constantly get emails from listeners saying, well, would you ask these guests about the late summer and the fall and the winter? So we'll get to that as well. Eric asks on Twitter, Commissioner, when will antibody testing be made more available to the public? And Commissioner, I'll add this. Are the results of the antibody testing better now than they were initially? Because we were hearing about a lot of false negatives.
Great questions. People are very interested in antibody testing and hopeful that that will be a way of knowing whether you've been exposed and whether you're now immune. Unfortunately, the science is not there yet to at the individual person level for antibody test results to be all that determinative. And Chris can, I'm sure, chime in more here. Antibody testing is useful, and we are using it to try to get some estimates at a population level of past exposures. But what we don't know from antibody tests is just if you get an antibody test and it shows that you had been exposed previously, that doesn't really tell us anything about your susceptibility to be reinfected at this point in time. So there are, and another concern is just there are a lot of tests coming on the market really rapidly without necessarily the usual rigor of evaluating the sensitivity and the accuracy of those tests. But Chris may have some additional thoughts there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Chris, if I might just zero in on, are they worthwhile now? I mean, at the moment, is that something we ought to care about getting?
Well, as the commissioner said, there have been a lot of tests that have been flooding the market. Many of them are not FDA approved. And I think one of the things that you need to be considering are, you know, as the commissioner said, first of all, we don't know what level of protection is needed for someone to know that they're not going to be susceptible going forward, and we don't know how long that protection would last. So those are two important things that we don't know yet, and that's one of the gaps in terms of antibody testing. But the other thing is that depending on the test, some of these tests are not specific to SARS-CoV-2, meaning the actual virus that causes COVID, but they are more broad and will let you know if you've had an infection with coronavirus. Well, I think as people have heard over time, over the course, since we all know so much more about coronaviruses than we did in January, I think people are aware now that there are viruses in the coronavirus family that can cause the common cold. 40% of rhinovirus or colds are thought to be caused by a coronavirus. So if you happen to get tested by one of the antibody tests that is just general for coronavirus, it may show that, hey, there's presence of antibody, and that's because you had a cold last October, and it's picking that up. So I think we want people to be cautious about getting tested and how they interpret those results, because there are a lot of gaps at this point.
Okay.
The thing we want to get to is a point where we know what level of antibody a person has to have that is protective or that can, you know, neutralize the virus. And then our other goal is over time, we want to know how long that protection will last. Because we know for some viruses like measles, you know, you get measles disease and basically just about everyone has lifelong protection. So that's what would be the ultimate best answer for coronavirus, for COVID, but we don't have that information right now.
That's great. I mean, that's really clarifying. I appreciate that because we always get questions when we do these shows about antibody testing. So good to know. A call here from Leslie in St. Paul. Hi, Leslie. Thanks for waiting.
Sure. I am in a very high risk category, although I do live alone, so I have just about every risk factor there is except for living in a group setting.
Okay.
I have three questions. I think I can be quick and succinct.
All right.
One is I was tested. I had a couple of symptoms last week. Because I'm so high risk, I did qualify for a test. I got it quickly. I got the results the next day. It came out negative.
Okay.
Two questions. One, how can I know what the probability is of a false negative on that?
Okay.
Two, why was I charged a $45 copay when I thought it was supposed to be a free test? And three, my daughter, who lives on the East Coast, is planning to drive the 1,200 miles in a couple of weeks to see me. She has been staying away for fear of being an asymptomatic young person carrier and coming to see me. Obviously, I'm
So is there a risk there, you're saying? Yeah.
Well, what I want to know is if there is a way that she can get tested as an asymptomatic carrier once she gets to Minnesota before she comes into my house.
Okay. So, Chris, on this false negative, Leslie saying she tested negative, how likely is it that she's truly negative?
Well, a couple of things. You know, one thing to keep in mind is not every respiratory illness that's occurring in Minnesota right now would be COVID. So that's one thing to just keep in the back of your mind. The other thing is that depending on the timing for being tested, you know, if you're tested too early in the course of the illness, you may have a false negative. Now, it sounds like you had symptoms. And so my expectation would be that if you had symptoms and you tested positive, that it's quite likely that, you had symptoms and you tested negative.
Right.
It's quite likely that you really are negative. I mean, certainly no test is 100% and you can get some false negatives. But in your case, because you had symptoms and you went in to get tested after that, I think it's likely that it was truly a negative test. That's the greater likelihood than that it was a false negative. I cannot speak to the copay because I think that was waived.
I'll ask the commissioner about that. But Chris, would you weigh in on the daughter coming from the East Coast being concerned about being asymptomatic and bringing the virus into the house?
Well, we acknowledged, as we talked about earlier, that there is that issue, that concern of asymptomatic transmission. And I think a couple things to ask about would be, you know, is she also been sort of isolated? How, you know, is she been exposed a great deal in her work and living situation? That's something to keep in mind. And then certainly, you know, there is more testing that's becoming available now for individuals who are asymptomatic. I mean, so she could check and see if that's a possibility. But I think that the important thing to think about would be to evaluate her interactions with other people. Because, again, a negative test is just a single point in time. So if you test negative today, if she got tested today and she's negative and great and she visits you, it could be that in 3 days she develops symptoms and do you know what I mean?
It's because
not
it's
a
incubating. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So the important thing would be for her to evaluate who she has been around and, if possible, to keep herself isolated for the number of days before she travels. And if she can keep herself isolated and if she's driving out, I know it takes a while, then she could possibly have a 14-day period where she's not been exposed, and that would make a difference.
Commissioner, the copay. I thought that there were no copays for testing.
Yeah, that's correct. The Minnesota-based health plans have agreed to waive the copays. You know, it's possible that there are a lot of insurers, obviously, around the country, depending on which company Leslie has her insurance through. They may not have been a party to that agreement, but I would hope and expect that they would. So, Leslie, you sound like a very thorough and thoughtful person. You probably perhaps have already done this, but I would check back with your insurance carrier and say, hey, what's this? Why did I get a copay? And see if they won't agree to address that retroactively. Or you can also contact us at the health department, and we can assist with that if need be.
Great. Gabe says on Twitter, I've been out at the protest doing my best to social distance and wear a mask. However, mostly for my peace of mind, I'd like to get tested. But when I've looked online, it seems like you need to have symptoms to be tested. Can you ask your guests if that's true? Commissioner, do you have to be showing symptoms to qualify for a test, or can anybody get a test right now?
Particularly in light of the events of this last week, we just yesterday sent out new guidance clarifying that asymptomatic people who had any connection to those events, either protesting themselves, you know, helping with cleanup, you know, providing food and water to protest or anything like that, we are encouraging people to get tested. If they were a part of those activities. So, Gabe, thank you for taking all that care that you did. But yes, you you certainly should qualify for a test and are welcome to get one.
I want to put this in here. Bill called in and he says, I drive down Excelsior Boulevard toward Highway 100 every morning. There's an entire parking lot dedicated to testing. I never see more than two cars there at a time. I don't see why this site is so underutilized. Do you think it's possible, Chris, that people, that the information isn't available enough about where you can go get testing? And so people, you know, medical professionals are standing around waiting for people to come in?
It may be that people aren't aware of testing sites. The other thing may be that people more recently, and I don't know if Bill is talking about the last few days, if people have been reluctant to be more out and about given all the unrest of the last few days. But definitely there are testing sites, and I think as people have heard, we aren't fully utilizing the testing capacity that we do have. So the only thing I'd say is that many sites do ask that you make an appointment. So they're not, just because it's a drive-through testing, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a drive up and get tested. Many ask that you call in advance. So that would be the only thing that I would check is just, and we've asked, as the commissioner said, we put out a health alert yesterday that indicated the offering of expanded testing for asymptomatic individuals because of the events of the weekend. But it still is important that people are calling ahead to make sure that they have an appointment. The other consideration is that the time frame, the incubation period for COVID is from 2 to 14 days. So that means that if you're exposed today, that between 2 and 14 days, you know, going forward, that's when we would expect that someone could develop symptoms. And most commonly, people develop symptoms around 5 to 7 days. And as I was just explaining to Leslie, you know, the timing of when the test is taken in the course of your illness can make a difference. If you get tested too early, you know, you may get a false negative if you get tested before you have symptoms. And because we're telling asymptomatic people that they can be tested, we want to make sure that they're, you know, they weren't at an event yesterday and they go in to get tested today. That is, that timing is too soon.
Got
so we
it.
Want to make sure that
okay.
they're considering that, you know, kind of 5 to 7 day window. And certainly if they develop symptoms, they definitely want to get tested right away. But just keep that in mind as you're seeking testing. And the one thing I started to say, and I kind of got off on my train of thought there, was just that we did let health systems know that we want to make sure that they're really eliminating barriers for people to be tested so that they're making it available for anyone who feels the need to be tested. So we've asked them to consider that.
Two guests this morning who are managing the pandemic in Minnesota, Minnesota Health Department Commissioner Jan Malcolm and Chris Ayersman. She's the Infectious Disease Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. Taking your calls and questions this morning about testing, the availability of testing. We just got some really good guidance from Chris about if you don't have symptoms, but you feel like you were exposed, particularly if you've been out protesting, you need to be thinking about the incubation period of this virus and choosing a time during that incubation period to get tested. Where to get tested? What about some of the, I want to come back to these questions about people who are asymptomatic. That is an intriguing and difficult part of really pinning this disease down. So we'll talk more about that and your questions. Back to our conversation now with Commissioner Jan Malcolm, Chris Ayersman. She's Director of Infectious Diseases at the Minnesota Health Department. Commissioner, I want to ask you a bit about the Minnesota models, the different models that are coming out about what to expect in fall and winter. It looks like the U of M is projecting three possibilities here. The big wave we're experiencing, followed by smaller waves, a fall winter wave that is more deadly than the one we're in now. And of course, that happened in the 1918 flu epidemic. The third is a series of almost constant outbreaks. It just kind of stays on a simmer until at least 60% of the world has been exposed to the virus. Are you getting any kind of additional data to tell you which one of those models we may be headed for?
Well, we would all love to see a little bit more consensus among the experts on what is most likely, but unfortunately we just don't have that consensus at this point. Those are all credible theories about what could happen depending upon how this virus, whether this virus is similar, more similar to one or another type of strain of influenza or coronavirus, as Chris was talking about earlier. So we think, you know, in some respects, the what we're seeing recently in the Minnesota data, you know, suggests that we've been kind of hovering around a bit of a plateau over the last couple of weeks with some ups and downs. So we may be seeing that pattern of smaller waves already. So it's definitely something we will continue to watch, to continue to try to plan around different scenarios of what the implications of either of those patterns might, any of those three basic patterns might be. But I think, you know, unfortunately, everybody, it's just human nature. We all would like to think, well, as soon as we hit the peak, whenever that is, and then things start to come back down, then all will be well. And unfortunately, with all the unknowns around this virus, including what we're seeing internationally, I think the reality is we have to be prepared for this to be a challenge that's with us for a long time, and that really continuing to practice some of these good protective personal health measures just is going to continue to be very important for quite a long time.
That's I can hear that in your voice, Commissioner, that it's difficult to tell people that, you know, what we're doing now, and actually what we're doing now is quite a bit more relaxed than what we were doing 45 days ago, but that may be necessary again, and it might be necessary for months and months. Is that right?
Well, that's correct. Just the fact that, you know, it's going to be a new normal for a while, with more attention to social distancing and, you know, continued real vigilance around people making good decisions for themselves, but also mindful of the impact of their decisions on other people around things like staying home when you're sick, not going out into crowds if you are ill, not thinking that just if you wear a mask, it's okay if you go out if you're sick, because that is not the case. So just keeping on really reinforcing these basic core measures that are going to have to be in place. And we all are going to have to take a significant amount of the responsibility for making good decisions while we try to restore as much normalcy as possible in terms of economic activity and people's ability to do things that are important to them.
Okay. Call here from Gary in Lakeville. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's your question for Chris Ayersman?
Well, I've got a relative who works in a care facility that's a residential facility, actually run by the state, that they were informed, and they work in close proximity with all of their co-employees.
Uh-huh.
And they were put in and they were informed that one of their employees or co-employees had contracted the COVID virus. But they asked who that person was, and their management would not tell them who it was, saying there was a HIPAA violation. It seems to me that seems absurd, or at least lesser important to protect someone's health and health privacy or health information when other people are potentially at risk or potentially have contracted or been exposed to a coworker who's got an infectious disease such as that, or even
okay.
tuberculosis or anything else.
Yeah, this is
and
Gary. If
I
think, Gary, we have the essence of it, and it's a really good question. Chris, privacy versus health in workplaces as more of our workplaces open up again.
Right. So, yes, the facility was correct about the limitations of disclosing information about a person if they haven't given permission. Sometimes an individual will say, yes, it's fine with me if you share my name in the workplace. I think the important thing is that we do have the ability, the commissioner has the ability, the authority, to override the data practices law in a situation where sharing a person's name or, you know, and their health information is absolutely necessary to protect the public's health. That is a tool that we use rarely because we want to make sure that we are maintaining individuals' privacy, their privacy of their medical status. I think what's important to consider is that for this situation in this facility, it's the reason that we wouldn't have necessarily pursued getting that release is because we're able to provide the information for this employee to be healthy, to know what type of exposure they might have had, to give them the information that they need without giving them the name of the individual. Does that make sense? So in other words, if we know that it's, I hate to choose names, but if we know that it's Mary that was the ill healthcare worker, we know what shifts Mary worked. We're working with the facility on that. We can provide them with the guidance that they need to protect the other employees without having the name provided. If there's a situation where it's not possible to do that, then we will look at whether or not we have to do something that is, you know, more dramatic, which is asking for this special order. But in general, in many cases, we are able to make recommendations that protect the coworkers and that provide them with the information they need to know about exposures without actually giving the person's name.
Okay. Yes, we can see that it is complicated. And there's probably a number of workplaces, Chris, that are going to have to work through this, right?
Yes, and we deal with this with other infectious diseases. So I know Gary mentioned tuberculosis, but there are plenty of times when we have a case of tuberculosis and we work within a workplace and we'll look at, you know, who may have been exposed and all of those things, and we can still, again, provide the information that's necessary for coworkers about their potential exposure, about what they need to do next, without divulging the name of the individual.
Okay, let me take a call here from Fio in Woodbury. Hi, Fio. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to ask, because I noticed that the rates of daily confirmed cases of corona have been downtrending from last week. I saw them from 800 go down to 300.
Okay.
Is that because there's the downtrend of cases or because there's way less testing these days with the protests?
Commissioner, are our cases trending down? I think you said something about a plateau.
Yes, we've over the last 2 weeks or so, we've seen some ups and downs and some significant changes day to day. So we're always cautious to say we've got a sustainable trend, but we at least have a pattern over the last couple of weeks that suggests stability, if not decline. So the last few days, as the caller notes, have been lower numbers of new cases added each day. So we fully expect, and we see that some of the testing volume has been down over those last few days. But I think that correlation of how much are we testing and how many positives are we finding is the real key. That caller was really right to make that connection, because what we want to see is all the testing that really should be done and is indicated just given facts on the ground, and a stable or falling case positivity rate. So those two metrics are very key.
Chris, what's happening in Nobles County? I was looking at a nationwide chart of where there are spikes in cases, and Nobles County looks like one of those places. What's happening there?
Nobles County is where the JBS plant is located. So I think if people recall, I guess it was a little over a month ago, that we were working with JBS, Port Processing Plant, on getting their employees tested, found a number of positives. And so that is largely what has driven both the number of cases in Nobles County, as well as we're seeing cases associated with the plant, then we also are seeing cases, additional cases in the community. So that's what makes Nobles look very unique at this point for the rest of Minnesota.
Okay. A question here on from Manny that I, yeah, here it is. Manny says, are the models even valid anymore, given the massive changes in mobility and congregation in the past few days? It's a good question, Chris. How should we view these models that admittedly came out, I don't know, like 2.5 or 3 weeks ago?
The models were generated as a tool to provide leadership with information on, you know, if you chose these community mitigation or mitigation events like a stay-at-home order or different things, how that could impact the progression of disease. And so they looked at, you know, if we open up on this date, if we stay closed forever, all of those things. And so the models gave different examples of what things might look like going forward based on how open we are. And certainly, I think, as, and the commissioner can comment more on this, but as, you know, we've said, the models, the individuals that are doing the modeling are continuously updating those and doing revisions based on new information. And I guess I'll turn it to the commissioner to say, are they planning to do an additional update now with the changes in our stay-at-home order and more of things, more businesses opening up?
Yeah, Commissioner?
Yeah, that was a good description, Chris. Thanks. The purpose of the models really is directional, and was how we've used it significantly is to really hone in on the importance of building up critical care capacity, because that's one of the variables that really most affects the ability of people who get exposed to make sure that we've got the care available when they need it. But yes, we will be doing updated runs of the models. And there is, as you noted, the University of Minnesota model. We're also looking at many other models around the nation, as well as looking at a whole bunch of different kinds of data that we at the health department have. So there are, as the governor said repeatedly, the university model is one very helpful input, but it's one among many. But we have asked for a run to be done trying to estimate the impact of the kinds of mass gathering events that we've been seeing.
If you've just gotten in on the show, by the way, you're hearing a conversation here with Chris Ayersman. She's Minnesota Department of Health Infectious Disease Director and Minnesota Health Department Commissioner Jan Malcolm. We have not yet talked about schools in the fall. I want to talk about that as well. To Scott in Edina. Scott, I know it's been quite a while. Thanks so much for waiting.
Oh, no problem, Carrie. Thanks for having Jan and Chris on. It's a great show. And my question more directly, I'll try to be quick because I know there's a lot of people waiting.
Okay.
If I, as a caregiver, family member, loved one of someone in hospice in a nursing home, am willing to be tested weekly, similar to staff, and I repeatedly test negative, will you set up a protocol with the nursing homes to allow us to come in and visit our loved ones and fulfill our obligations to our family members who may be dying in 3 months or 6 months or a year?
Scott, have we heard from you before on the show?
I talked to you last week.
I'm really glad you called back. You have not yet been able to go in and see your wife?
No, and I did have a conversation with the administrator yesterday who made it very clear, you know, that they're doing their heroic best efforts to keep this in check. More cases are coming in from staff than they are from showing up from actual residents. So, you know, my point is, whether you test staff, whether you test visitors,
some
you
kind
need to do
of
more testing.
Yeah, some kind
you
of
need
protocol
to do more testing to get on top of this. And whether it's me or a family member coming in once a week to see my loved one in a restricted area of the nursing home, so I have no other contact, if I'm testing negative, how am I a greater risk than a staff member going in there every day?
Yeah, and Chris, just to note again that Scott's wife is in a hospice nursing home. So how can we help?
Well, a couple things. One is that there are allowances for visitation for compassionate care and end-of-life care, and so that aspect of it is a little confusing to me, because if she is, at the end of her life, then that is an allowance that has been in place this whole time. So that is something that perhaps we can check on. The other thing is that we are working on protocols for, visitation that could occur outside, and looking at ways that there can be allowances made. I know that CMS does have some restrictions. So facilities that are under CMS, they have some federal restrictions that they have to follow. But so to Scott, first of all, I'm very sorry that you're going through this. That in itself is bad enough, and going through it in COVID is terrible. But yes, I think we want to check on that compassionate care option, and then to say that there is work being done on guidance that could be used for some limited visiting. So I don't know if that completely answers the question, but yes, that there should be an allowance in that situation.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is special coverage of the pandemic in Minnesota on NPR News. We did an hour with Commissioner Jan Malcolm, Minnesota Health Department, and Chris Ayersman, the Minnesota Department of Health Infectious Disease Director. But we have so many calls and questions that they have agreed to stay with us for a bit. The commissioner will have to go. Chris has agreed to stay with us until deeper into the hour. So I'm going to go right back to the calls here to David in St. Paul. David, thanks so much for waiting. What is your question for our guests?
Well, what I've been wondering about, I've been hearing comments about the fall and kids going back to school, but I've been thinking about the fall being the start of flu season and how we're going to be able to social distance and be able to get everybody flu vaccinations on top of the COVID testing that needs to be going on. And
good question.
Just what the capacity is out there for that.
Commissioner, what happens when the pandemic meets our usual seasonal flu season?
Well, that is a great question, and the focus of just a lot of discussion and planning within the public health community is how to manage both things simultaneously, and just the overlap in symptoms between these illnesses can make it even tougher to just distinguish what's what. Certainly the importance and the value of vaccinations for flu is always important, but perhaps even more so this year, just given this combination. That the good news is, I think we are building up the capacity to be able to do testing at a much, much broader scale, so that we can continue to test for COVID as the indications for that expand. We've talked a lot over the last hour about that. And one thing I wanted to be sure to mention, Carrie, is folks should know that there is a web page kind of devoted to keeping track of where testing locations are and what their hours are.
Okay.
So for your listeners, it's linked to the governor's COVID site. So that is mn.gov/COVID, COVID.
All right.
And you can right on the main page there's a link to a site that can help direct people to testing locations. So I just wanted to remember to get that out there.
I'll mention that again before we're finished. Chris, there are flu seasons where the vaccines that are available to us, still important to get one, but where they are not fully effective because some other strain emerges. What if we have a situation like that, even as we're dealing with the pandemic?
Well, certainly, as the commissioner said, we are thinking about the intersection of the annual influenza pandemic, because it does circulate globally, as well as COVID. Right now, our planning is focusing on making sure that we have as much influenza vaccine as we can available to people. And I want to point out that even when there are challenges with the match between the vaccine and the circulating viruses, mm-hmm. there is still some level of protection. So it's not the high level that we'd like to see. And with influenza vaccination, we don't get that 95 to 98% protection level that we get, say, with the measles vaccine. Mm-hmm. But even when you have a year with a poor match, there is still some protection. And I think that this year, you know, I even said this at my daughter's wedding, get a flu shot. So
how
I
romantic.
Say that everywhere. Exactly. I say that everywhere and at all times. But this year, even more than normal, we're going to want people to get vaccinated, because we need to make sure that we have as much protection in the community as we possibly can. Because as the commissioner said, you know, our focus has been making sure that healthcare can keep up with what we're seeing related to COVID, that we have the beds and the capacity to care for individuals. And our role as a community will be to get vaccinated so that we're not contributing to the need for healthcare because we have influenza.
Yeah, we will help spread the message. I hear you loud and clear on don't be turned away because, again, we have a year where, you know, you're not going to get the full efficiency or effectiveness from the vaccine. It is still, and hopefully it won't be like that, but it's still important to get the vaccination.
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay. Commissioner, before you have to go, I want to ask you about schools opening, and then we're going to take a call from a teacher. How are you planning for the opening of schools? And are you getting specific plans back from school districts about how they're going to manage this?
Well, we are so grateful and impressed by the hard work that the school districts around the state are doing to adjust to these realities. I think what they're doing and what we're advising is planning for various scenarios and I think school districts are being quite creative in thinking about, you know, mixed models of what could be done virtually versus in person. Are there ways to, get back to in-person education in a different way? So there's just a lot of really good thinking going on in the education sector around this, but partly because of what we talked about earlier, the fact that there are multiple potential scenarios out there of what will be happening in the fall. We so wish that we could give a more precise forecast, but the best we can do at this point is to talk about scenarios and encourage scenario planning. We're also really needing and looking for more data on the role of kids, not only in how they're experiencing the virus and the illnesses that result from it. Thankfully, kids have been less impacted, but their role in transmission is still something that's being studied. So, Chris may have more recent insight into that than I do.
Chris, let me grab this call from Tracy, who's a teacher in St. Paul, and maybe that'll inform how you answer this about schools. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My biggest concern is with the budgetary constraints of schools. I know at my school we just had 8 full-time staff cuts. That puts us at, in many of our classes of 40, which is our contractual limit. In addition to that, we have custodial cuts where our classrooms now are only being swept, and swept only, and garbage taken out every 3 days. And so I just don't see how are we going to make this safe for our teachers, for our students? Is there going to be help from the state to, you know, help school districts with all of these considerations when opening schools?
Yeah, I mean, this seems really hard to parse out, Chris, at this point. Seems pretty foggy about how we're going to manage this. What do you think?
Well, I agree. I agree that there are no easy answers for COVID. In fact, I just was thinking that and thinking, oh, and I've signed myself up for 40 more minutes of giving answers that are hard.
Yes.
But,
hooray.
But so no, there are no easy answers for COVID. I think that Tracy makes a good point that one of the messages that we've been getting out is the importance of making sure that businesses, that plants, that all of those, you know, parts of society are doing good cleaning and making sure that there is the opportunity for cleaning that's going on. And so, yes, yeah, certainly if there are cuts in that area, I can see where you'd be concerned. I think it's our Department of Education that's making the, you'll be giving the guidance on schools opening with input from the department. And I think that I think their goal is to be prepared for kind of multiple eventualities. So be prepared for online, be prepared for hybrid. But I do want to acknowledge that Tracy does make a good point that it is important that if we are together in a location, that we are sanitizing, that we are cleaning doorknobs and all of those kinds of things. I can't personally speak to help from the state for that. I'm sure that districts may be reaching out to say that this is an issue that needs to be discussed by the legislature, you know, in anticipation of fall. But it's a valid concern, and that cleaning is an important aspect, and it's a recommendation that we do make.
Tracy, are you still there?
Yes.
Yeah. So are you getting any kind of guidance yet from your school district, and what are you looking for?
We haven't gotten anything yet. We've gotten you know, the superintendent talking to us that they're in the planning stages, but nothing has been communicated out. I have talked to a teacher in a neighboring district, and they just got an email giving them 5 different planning options and,
oh my gosh,
you know,
yeah,
to vote on it. It's concerning at the secondary level, especially in the elementary level, you have more where the students can be in one, we usually have just one teacher and the special teachers rotate in and out, and they could. But when you're talking secondary level, with that many kids in a class, that we could be up to 40 in a class, and then everybody's on different paths as far as what classes you take. So there's no, you know, clear way to say, oh, only ninth graders come this day. Well,
right,
if it's only ninth graders, you still have a class of 40 ninth graders in one classroom.
Yeah.
So it's just a lot to consider. And I'm, you know, in talking to my fellow teachers, we have a lot of teachers that are worried, a lot of teachers that are in the risk group. We have a lot of older teachers, you know, lots of teachers with, you know, pre-existing conditions. So it's just a lot to think about. And, you know, with schools being so under budget now,
right,
I'm just so worried, and then hearing from the kids day after day how they miss us, how they want to come back, and then trying to talk to them about we have to be safe. And it's just been a lot of stress this last couple of weeks. And then on top of that, the protests and everything going on in the Twin Cities, it's made for a very, you know, stressful time for our kids too. So
you also, Tracy, I'm glad you called, but you also brought something up, Chris, that I hadn't thought of, which is teachers who, you know, the risk of exposure is raised for them because they have some pre-existing conditions, and what schools may have to do to replace teachers who don't feel safe enough to be in the classroom. It's a conundrum, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, it is a conundrum, and that's why I have to give props to our partners at the Department of Education, because, as Tracy alluded to, they are looking at multiple different scenarios, and as you've heard on the call earlier, you know, the commissioner, and we don't have a crystal ball, so we can't say, well, this is what's going to happen, so plan for X.
Right.
We have to say there could be multiple different things, and so they're trying to plan for all of those things. But yes, if teachers are not available to teach, so if there was a situation in which, say, a hybrid learning environment was appropriate, given the existing circumstances in September, and then you have teachers who have underlying conditions who then would not be comfortable or could not safely be in a classroom setting, that is a challenge. I mean, during influenza season, I'm sure people have heard us say, the department doesn't make a recommendation to close a school or close a district, but oftentimes the administrators will say, you know what, we've got this proportion of people out because of illness. We can't function without those people here. And
right.
That could be the case prior to having disease, but rather to say we've got this many people who can't be here because of concerns about COVID, we may not have the staffing that we need.
Wow. We've had so many calls and very good questions, and Chris Ayersman has agreed to stay with us here for a bit more time. She's the Minnesota Department of Health Infectious Disease Director. And actually, these calls from Tracy and others have reminded me that if you are going back to work and you're wondering how this is going to be managed in whatever work site you're in, what kinds of questions are coming up about that? How comfortable do you feel about going back to work and resuming your profession with your colleagues? To Jan in Richmond, Minnesota. Hi, Jan. Thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for your great show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've been in the hair industry a long time, and I'm also a high-risk person, but I just don't see this not being a problem in our industry. You can't avoid being close to people. And my sister's been back to work in Iowa for 2 weeks now doing hair, and she says people, you know, they pull their mask down to talk. People talk when they get their hair done. I just see it's not if people are going to get infected in the hair salon, it's when. And New York City just released their guidelines for hairdressers,
mm-hmm.
and it's mandatory that they get tested every 2 weeks, and the state is paying for it. What
mm-hmm.
are your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Chris, I'm going to say I got my hair done yesterday. We wore masks. We were very careful about it, but it probably isn't 100% certain. Right? Even in that situation.
Absolutely. I'm getting my hair cut tonight.
Okay.
But no, you're absolutely right. And that is why, you know, that was an industry that was shut down early and was slower to come back. And the recommendations that we put in place were intended to help minimize the potential for transmission. But yes, there is a potential that is still there. You know, the goal is that with both the person who is providing the service as well as the client wearing masks, that will help. I know where I'm getting my hair cut tonight won't blow dry. They won't wash your hair. They're really trying to do things that will minimize those closer interactions where right. the beautician is kind of over right in your face working in your hair. But it's a real concern. We are not at the point where we're recommending or mandating testing every 2 weeks in Minnesota, but we have put guidance in place to limit the exposures that occur in those settings. And we do recognize that it is a concerning setting. And as I said, that's why we had delayed the opening and wanted to make sure that it was a much more controlled environment as much as possible before people did resume services.
Carlos in Minneapolis says, I have a school plan. My son has asthma. He will be homeschooled. There's too much we don't know about COVID and how it will work in a school, but I do know my son's health, so I'm making a decision with the information I have. Matt in Ely called to say, I heard earlier that if you were in a protest, they're encouraging you to get tested. But if you go into Walmart with the same number of people, you should only get tested if you have symptoms. Although I don't think people are standing and walking that close together as they were at the protests, Matt, in Walmart. But he asks, Chris, what's the difference?
Well, that's a good question. I think that the difference is that in a grocery setting, that the or a Walmart setting, I guess it's more than groceries, but in those settings, it is possible to social distance. It's a much more controlled environment. But in a protest or in a riot or any of those settings, it is less controlled. There are so many more people in a closed space that it is much more difficult to control the environment. We look at some of the kind of concepts that we look at about situations are predictability, unpredictability. And in some situations, it's much more predictable and you have much more control. And in those settings, you can mask, you can social distance, you can do all of those things. That would be a lower risk, whereas in a setting like a protest, yes, you can try to social distance, but when you have so many people coming together, it makes it much more difficult. And so there's the unpredictability factor there, as well as the much larger number of individuals. So all of those things played into that recommendation.
Chris, I'm seeing some reporting on something that the former FDA commissioner Scott Gottlieb said this morning on CNBC. He was talking about Arizona and the scope of the rise and the velocity of the cases is concerning. And he added this: it's going to be very hard, though, for a lot of these governors to go backward and start implementing mitigation again. We talked about schools. Is there a scenario where we've opened up, we've lived whatever this new normal is for a couple of months, and we have to retreat back and do much more restrictive measures to stop the virus in the fall?
Unfortunately, that is a possibility, and Governor Walz has talked about the fact that, you know, he's going to continue to be monitoring the situation and monitoring some key indicators. And if we start to see concerns about the direction that those indicators are going, it may be necessary to pull back. Certainly, if we start to see a situation in which we are seeing, you know, many, many more cases, our healthcare system is unable to keep up, that would be a situation in which it might be necessary to pull back and have more stringent orders on what people can do. I know that he's weighing that very carefully. It's difficult for all of us. If I didn't have my public health infectious disease hat on,
yeah,
and was just expressing my feelings as a Minnesotan in summer, I just want to be able to do what I want.
Right.
And I completely understand how people are feeling that way. And so we want people to have the freedom to move about, but we are going to continue to monitor the situation. And if things change and we see that they are not, it's not going in the right direction, and so, you know, we fear that our healthcare system is not able to handle it and people won't be able to get the care they need to save their life, then the governor may have to make some difficult decisions and turn the dial back.
I have just one follow-up on that, and then we'll go back to the phones. I think I asked you this last time. You know, Mike Osterholm has continued to be talking about how no more than 5 to 6% of the world's population has been exposed to this virus, which makes most of us vulnerable to it. And he adds, he was talking to Stat News about this, and he added, this virus is going to keep finding people. We're in for the long haul. Now, you and Commissioner Malcolm were suggesting this, but when I think about what that quote-unquote herd immunity has to get to, what is it, like 60, 65% till we don't have to take the kind of precautions we're talking about? We are such a long way from that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very sobering, and you're right. I mean, and for some diseases, you need even a higher level of herd immunity than the, you know, sort of 60 to 70%. I think for me, the thing that I am, you know, really looking toward is a vaccine. And I know that, you know, that's an area that I've been focused on in my career, and never more have I been desirous of a vaccine than I am now. But until we have that, until we have the ability to provide that herd immunity through a vaccine, we are at risk. And Mike is absolutely right. I mean, we have a huge portion of our population that's still susceptible. And until that is raised, either by disease or because of vaccination, we're going to be dealing with the impact of COVID.
Yeah. You know, I'll point our audience to the discussion we had yesterday with a virologist and a vaccinologist. And one of our guests, Dr. Deborah Fuller, is actually in the lab day to day working on a vaccine. And they agreed that a vaccine is probably not going to be available, widely available, because of all the stages of testing until fall 2021. Does that sound right to you, Chris? If then.
Yeah, absolutely. No, there are a number of phases, you know, because of the need both for a vaccine to be safe and effective. So it's not just being effective, it has to be safe. Because of those elements, yes, it does take a while. Now, the good news is that there are multiple groups that are working on vaccination, and they're working on vaccines using multiple different methodologies.
Right.
But the challenge is it's getting the vaccine, it's knowing it's safe, it's knowing it's effective, and then obviously it's the system to get that vaccine distributed. So I'm very eager to hear. I'm on the National Vaccine Advisory Committee, and we have not had meetings recently because of COVID, but I'll be very interested to hear more about what's taking place. But the speaker yesterday is absolutely right. Making a vaccine is not like, you know, mixing a cocktail.
Yeah. For listeners who missed the show, it's on the podcast right now. So to Garnetta in Bloomington. Garnetta, thank you so much for waiting. And I think you called back, and I'm glad you did.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. I'm finding that a lot of the immunocompromised information is kind of lumped together, and a lot of people in my community are HIV/AIDS affected, and so I'm wondering if there's any particular information about how the virus is affecting those communities, maybe even talking a little bit about those who are undetectable. Are there higher rates of infection, or, you know, is it affecting them at a closer amount?
Okay, good question. Chris?
Thanks, Garnetta. That is a really good question. I don't have specific data right now about HIV, but we do, you know, the HIV STD area is in our division, and I will reach out to staff and make sure that we are putting some things out to partners and to the HIV community to give more information about what we do know related to HIV and COVID, beyond, as you said, just the if you're immunocompromised, you know, be aware. So I will follow up on that and have our team look at how we can get information out to the community.
Great. And just a reminder here again, Commissioner Malcolm told us that you can find information at mn.gov/COVID. So, Chris, I would imagine that's where you'll be posting some of the information that Garnett is interested in?
Yes, as
okay,
well as
good.
We have multiple partners in the community, and we can push it out that way as well.
Okay. We heard from Nick in Columbia Heights, who's a bus driver. He says, we're also concerned about school in the fall. And a call from Brian in St. Paul. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Great program. Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you.
So I have a question about the rate of false negatives. I actually have symptoms, and I got my test results a couple days ago, and it came back undetected, so negative. But what I heard was that there is at least as high of a false negative rate of 20%. So I'm wondering, you know, with all the statistics as to the rate of infection, whether that is actually a lot lower given the high percentage of false negatives. And then on a personal level, I'm just wondering if I should get retested if my symptoms continue.
Okay.
So, good question. There is a potential for false negatives. So, I think as you've possibly heard us talk about, because people are hearing about all these concepts more than they ever have in the past. When we look at a diagnostic test, there's a sensitivity, there's a specificity, there's, you know, how good is it at detecting positives, how good is it detecting negatives, that type of thing. So there is no test is 100% perfect. I have not heard the 20% rate. I had heard potential for possibly 10%. And what I'd say to you is, yes, if your symptoms continue, you may want to consider getting tested. Although, just to remind people that COVID is not the only, you know, respiratory illness that is circulating. So we have to keep that in mind. But certainly, if you continue to have symptoms, that you may want to consider getting tested again.
Call here from Carol in Roseville. Hi, Carol. I'm glad you called. This is about work. Yes?
Yes. Good. I work for a large, high-traffic discount retailer, and I encounter hundreds of people every day at work. And my question is, why don't we mandate masks for both employees and customers in retail? I haven't been working because the compliance on both of those aspects has been about 50% as far as my observation.
So your company is not saying that the employees or the visitors have to be wearing masks. Is that right, Carol?
Right.
Okay.
They encourage the employees to, but still only about half the employees do.
And you're asking, Chris, why not a mandate on that?
Correct.
Okay. Chris?
Actually, you know, we certainly have been talking about the role that masks can play in reducing the potential for transmission and, you know, what level. I mean, right now we have our guidance is we strongly encourage, and so we are evaluating, do we need something stronger than strongly encourage? I know that employers are expected to have plans in place for keeping employees safe as well as the guests to their facilities. And some are requiring masks and are requiring masks for their guests. And so I guess what I'd say is I'm not sure, you know, if why your employer has chosen to not, you know, expect their employees to wear masks or expect their guests to wear masks. But I'll say that we are looking at whether or not our strongly encourage is a strong enough recommendation. Just to be clear, the mask wearing, when we're talking about the cloth mask, we are talking about wearing a mask to protect others. It is, you know, intended to catch large droplets and things from the wearer. So my mask protects you. When you wear a mask, it protects me. So, and that's, we are looking at whether or not our guidance should be stronger on that.
Chris, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you staying with us. I mean, above and beyond the call of duty here for this morning. So thank you much. Thanks for all the good information and the time.
Oh, happy to be with you next time. Perhaps easier questions.
All right. All right. Good luck with that hair appointment.
You.
All right. Chris Harrisman with us. She's the Minnesota Department of Health Infectious Disease Director. By the way, I just want to remind you again, if you missed the conversation yesterday about the quest for a vaccine, we also had some excellent questions for our guests and really informative answers. That's on the podcast. You can find that anywhere you listen to NPR News, and then just search NPR News with Carrie Miller for the podcast.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at Carrie NPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.